Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is Truth Finder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give Truth Finder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing, but you got to click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time. Welcome to Season 2 of Profiling Evil Podcasts, Cults Among Us. These podcasts are dedicated to discussions about cults, cult recruiting techniques, and methods to escape cult influences. We've already talked about Heaven's Gate, Nexium, and the Children of God, and I thought this would be a perfect time to divert slightly and talk a little bit about the definition of a cult. A cult is best described as a social group, defined by its unusual religious, spiritual, or philosophical beliefs. Cults can be frighteningly destructive, like the People's Temple. Now, the opposite end of the spectrum would be cults that are not destructive, often referred to as benign. When most people think of or use the word cult to describe a group, they usually do it in a way that prompts contempt and disapproval. Historically, the use of the word cult involved religious practices focused on a particular figure or place. Even religious organizations often label other faiths or theologies as cults if they have a differing doctrine. The layperson, according to religion scholar Megan Goodwin, would simply identify any religion that they don't like as a cult. Academically, groups such as sociologists might choose to classify cults as social groups with ideologies that they determine are socially deviant or outside what is considered orthodox. In other words, any belief system that's outside traditionally accepted and approved theologies could be considered a cult. Now, it's estimated that there are more than 5,000 cults operating in the world at any given time. Some experts suggest that those numbers are conservative. That's hard to believe. I mean, anyway, the late Dr. Margaret Singer estimated that there were roughly 3,000 cults operating in the United States alone a few years back. Those groups range in size from a few followers to international organizations that have literally millions of adherents. It would be easy to become consumed with this discussion around cults and follow dozens of different angles in exploring the phenomenon. Instead, I think it'll be easier for us to differentiate cults simplistically by looking at the organizational behaviors of these groups and the positive and negative impact they have on their members. So, for purposes of our discussion today, we'll use the more commonly accepted terms of defining cults by categorizing them as benign or destructive in nature. I have learned a great deal from cult experts like Dr. Yanya Lalik and Rick Ross. I really like Rick's description of benign cults. He said that, quote, benign cults are any group of people that are intensely devoted to a person, place, or thing, close quote. And he went on where the relationship between the follower and the leader or the group is harmless, benign, or even positive in nature. Now, in other words, benign cults don't hurt their followers physically or emotionally. The leaders are generally accountable to the group, and they receive and accept feedback from their followers. Benign cults are welcoming. They don't charge you in one way or another to be part of them. The most defining characteristic of a benign cult is this desire they have to fill emotional needs in a positive way. Their actions seem outward and focused on strengthening the group or individuals that they deem are less fortunate. Destructive cults, on the other hand, are a completely different animal. This type of group will generally have an authoritarian leader at the helm, and there's no question who that person is. It would be an individual like Jim Jones, a self-appointed superstar with absolute control over his followers. Now, these types of leaders don't really care about the well-being of group members. In fact, I'm going to call them predators. These predators exploit and abuse the victims that they have, or the members, usually for their own benefit. In short, the leaders of destructive cults hurt, harm, manipulate, and often brainwash their members. Listen as Rick Ross and I talk about what defines a cult in his opinion.
Well, I think of myself as a relative conservative on that point, and I think it's important to have a very firm and concise definition, because we don't want to call everything a destructive cult. Very few groups measure up to that definition. And I would say there are three core characteristics that form the nucleus for a definition of a destructive cult. And they were first identified by psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton in the 80s in a paper that was published at Harvard University, Cult Formation. The first and most single salient characteristic of a destructive cult is an omnipresent leader that is dictatorial, that runs everything. Whatever he says is right, is right. Whatever he says is wrong, is wrong. Frequently very charismatic. And this leader becomes an object of worship for the group. He controls everything. Second, that the group uses a process Lifton called thought reform, or can be seen as coercive persuasion, to gain undue influence over people, to break them down, make them over, engender dependency, and basically create a deployable pawn that can be used by the group. And then finally, if the group is to be considered a destructive cult, they're hurting people in some way. And this varies by degree from group to group. So you have groups like you've dealt with, these polygamous groups that are stockpiling weapons and being involved in criminal action and quite dangerous potentially, to groups that are simply exploiting people for money, free labor, sexual favors, etc. Not all groups are equally destructive that are destructive cults.
Well, this is where cults really differ from mainstream religion. Think about it. A mainstream faith tradition focuses on developing or improving its members, lifting the downtrodden. They strive for equity among mankind, and the leaders are considered servants themselves. Cult leaders, on the other hand, are consumed with their own power. They're consumed with increasing the level of dominion and control that they have in the present and in what they hope will be the future. Listen again as Rick and I talk about these destructive cult leaders and the challenge of helping people who have been on the inside.
Yeah, I mean, you have someone like David Koresh, who was the focus of the Waco Davidians, Keith Raniere, who was the focus of Nexium, though Nexium was not a religious organization, but rather a supposedly self-help, self-improvement, seminar-selling, for-profit company, which became a personality cult. And of course, Charles Manson with the Manson family, who's perhaps the most notorious cult leader of modern history, and Jim Jones, who led the People's Temple that ended in tragedy in 1978 in mass suicide in Guyana. Jones really was an object of worship. People felt he had supernatural powers, that he received revelation, and they worshiped him. They talked about his Christ power, that he could intervene in events, that he could heal people. So whenever you see a group that has at its center this leader who can never be questioned, who is infallible, who can never be wrong, and who is not accountable through any checks and balances, not elected but rather self-proclaimed, self-chosen, and dictatorial and absolute in his or her power. That's a big red flag, and you're probably dealing with a destructive cult.
During my investigation into numerous cults, I found that the leader of the group was most often the person who created and preached these troubling ideologies. Now, as weird and off-base as many of their ramblings sounded to me, I was always a little more concerned about the rabid follower of the leader. You know who this is, that person who's likely to try to prove their allegiance either to the doctrine or just to the figurehead. In my experience, this individual or individuals are more likely to act out the bizarre teachings than the leader themselves. Take Dan Lafferty, for instance. He and his brother Ron believed that they were prophets of God. Ron was senior in authority in that self-proclaimed line of authority. Whenever Ron wanted something done by his brother Dan, he simply would say, "I've received a revelation." And then he would remind Dan, "Dan, I am the voice of God, and you are lucky enough to be the arm of God." Well, in other words, when Ron declared that his sister-in-law Brenda and her baby Chloe needed to be murdered, it was Dan who stepped up to do the dirty work. Well, thankfully, these predators were found guilty of those murders and they spent their lives in prison. Wouldn't it have been better if we could have stopped them in advance? Ron Lafferty died in prison a few years ago, and Dan's still living. In fact, you can hear him share his beliefs by watching a video that I created, an interview that I had with him titled "Ritual Murder: The Killer Speaks from Prison." You can get that on Profiling Evil. But now, let's go to my interview with Rick Ross, where we discuss this phenomenon of member allegiance.
I think it's all about behavior. It's not about what the group believes. It's about how the group behaves. Are they hurting people? How are they hurting people? Is it criminal? Is it subject to a civil lawsuit? Are there children involved? Are they being compromised? Is there medical neglect? Is there extreme corporal punishment? So if you're looking at a group, you're scrutinizing it, and you're thinking in terms of this group is very destructive and their destructive behavior needs to be addressed, you take it on the basis of what crimes have they committed on a point-by-point, case-by-case basis. So you'll have people stepping forward, young people who have been hurt, families that have been devastated. And as they make their claims, the group is accountable. Because in the United States, you have the right to believe whatever you want, but you don't have the right to do whatever you wish in the name of those beliefs. So we have polygamist groups in the U.S., as you know, and you've studied them extensively. And Warren Jeffs, for example, the leader of the FLDS, the so-called fundamentalist polygamists, he is in prison running his group from Texas. And he is in prison because he's a pedophile, he raped children, and he was involved in criminal activities and a criminal conspiracy. And so that is how these leaders go down, not because they're benign, because they're not doing anything wrong, but rather because they have committed criminal offenses. So in my view, if a group is really strange, and they have a charismatic leader, and they have a certain mindset that they promote through their process of training or indoctrination, and they do no harm, they don't hurt anyone, then really we shouldn't be looking at that group because they're not harming anyone, and therefore they're not subject to scrutiny.
Rick's comments caused me to reflect on my own career of investigating these closed societies, cults, and individual crimes of ritual abuse. I want to take you back for a moment to the mid-1990s. News reports focused on an unfolding litany of horrific tales of satanic-motivated crimes. In my state of Utah, the legislature sponsored a statewide poll, and they learned that more than 90% of the state's population believed that satanic crimes were happening on a regular basis. It's amazing. It led to an investigative mandate on the Attorney General's office to investigate these allegations and gain a clearer understanding of the problem. Well, because I had experience with the Zion Society, I was appointed to lead this statewide effort. Our task force was cross-designated as U.S. Marshals so that we could examine interstate crimes. Ultimately, we investigated more than 300 cases of ritual abuse, primarily involving children. This period came to be known as the Satanic Panic Era, and it was filled with allegations of abuse, mostly uncovered by therapists in therapy sessions. In some cases, the memories associated with those allegations were determined to be artifacts of a new diagnosis called false memory syndrome. Well, part of our responsibility during that three-year assignment was to look at providing training to law enforcement officers around the country in useful techniques and strategies for cult investigations. We spent a great deal of time encouraging investigators to look beyond the sensationalism of these ritual crimes. Instead, we taught them to focus on the core criminal elements of the crimes. Now, that we felt would keep the courts and the juries focused on crimes like sexual assault or public assistance fraud, instead of going off on these tangents about the voodoo and mysticism that accompanied discussions about the occult. While he was in an entirely different profession and a different part of the country, I found my discussion with Rick Ross about this satanic panic era to be really interesting. Let's listen in.
Well, in my experience, and I lived through that satanic panic era in the 1980s, it just turned out to be so much smoke and mirrors, anecdotal stories, no objective evidence. The FBI did a full investigation. They found nothing. There were local police departments, government agencies that looked into it based on the stories they'd heard. But that's what they were. They were stories. You know, where were the human remains? Where was the forensic evidence to substantiate these claims of satanic ritual abuse? My experience, I didn't see them. Now, with Warren Jeffs, he ritually abused children in the temple in the Yearning for Zion Ranch in Texas. And that's a matter of fact established by audio tape and direct evidence. So I think you have to follow the evidence. If the evidence substantiates the claim, then there could be a criminal prosecution. But if all people have is anecdotal stories and they have no objective evidence, I think we have to move on, because there are many, many destructive cults, and some of them are quite pernicious, and they are hurting people, and we need to focus our energies, our resources, our attention on those groups, not urban myths.
Well, we became quite good at that time in identifying abuses against children and focusing on violations of the law without getting consumed with the tantalizing distractions of cult behaviors. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that the cases were any easier to investigate or prosecute. On the contrary, there was so much noise and distraction about these cult-like behaviors that it often became a challenge just to keep prosecutors and the courts, and undoubtedly the media, focused on the violations of law and the victimizations that occurred, not the ghost stories. It was even more challenging to determine and then later evaluate what victimizations occurred against seemingly intelligent adults who chose to become part of an offending group or cult. Were these people also victims? Should they be treated differently, knowing that they committed assaults against others, especially children?
Well, absolutely. There are groups that basically clean people out financially. I can't begin to tell you over the years that I dealt with Keith Raniere how many people he financially broke until they had nothing. And it was very sad. And there are other groups that, you know, just siphon off money. For example, the Church of Scientology. If you get involved in that, you're talking about a lot of money. That get ready for a big sucking sound at your bank, because your money is going to be moving, and you're going to find that in order to continue in the coursework and the auditing and everything that's involved in Scientology, it can be very expensive. But, you know, Mike, it's the personal devastation that frequently happens that is so sad. I mean, people become estranged from their family. For example, the family asks critical questions about their involvement in a group, and the group says, cut them off. Don't talk to them anymore. Shun them. And so families become estranged. Parents become estranged from their children. Children from parents who become involved in some groups. And then the psychological and emotional damage done to people. The fact that they may have deferred their education. They may have changed their career plans to suit what the cult leader or the people in the group advised them to do. And once they've gone down that road, they can't go back and change it. And so people who have spent, many of them, many years in destructive cults, when they leave, find that their life has been changed. It's been altered. And so many opportunities that they might have had, those are gone. And they may have family members who have died that they cannot have closure with over the pain and suffering that the family's gone through. So recovery can be very difficult. And the longer you're in, the harder it can be.
Once the cult seems to have its grip on the members, it can be incredibly difficult for people to leave. Some members find they cannot leave a cult, not because it prevents them, but more importantly, because they can't figure out how to do it. If they were victimized in the group, for one thing, they don't think anybody's going to believe their story, even if they do escape. Now, while there are many parts of the cult that disgust these individuals, it sometimes boils down to the fact that the cult still provides a basic level of safety and security. In these circumstances, the victim is willing to put up with all of these abuses because they still have some of the basics: roofs over their head, food in their bellies. Some cult members stay inside the cult because they've formed meaningful relationships with others that would be terminated if they left. Again, and it's an internal and weird kind of a support system that may be keeping them there. And in many cases, some cult members are simply afraid to return to normal and more frightening societies in the world outside of the cult.
Yeah. Well, the group tells you you have nowhere to go. Your family doesn't understand you. Only we understand you. We are your family. We are everything for you. For example, Mike, you know this, that in these polygamous groups, they tell the young girls as they're growing up, if you don't stay with our community, if you don't marry who we tell you to marry, you will be cast into outer darkness for eternity. You will be separated from everyone and everything. You will not know God. You will have nothingness. And for eternity, you will be suspended alone in darkness. And so these young people are terrorized by these stories that they're told by the group. And so when people say to me, you know, Rick, look, you know, this woman was 18. She was 19 when she became the fifth wife of this polygamist in this group, you know, the Allred community, the Kingston clan, the FLDS or whatever. And it was her choice. It's consensual. I would say not really. If you are a young person who has been raised in a polygamous community, and Mike, you know these folks, and you've probably talked to so many of them, and they're conditioned. They don't feel they have a choice. based on their history and their indoctrination in the group, they feel that the only choice they have is obedience. And I think that's a shame, because so many of these women are abused, and they really are constrained in these groups. It's very sad.
Well, hey, folks, if you're enjoying this broadcast on cults, I hope you'll hit that like and subscribe button. And make sure you get notified on all of our videos in Season 2, Cults Among Us. If you'd like to learn more about cult dynamics and the recruiting tactics employed by cults, check out my book, Deceived, an investigative memoir of the Zion Society cult. It chronicles my investigation into a ritual cult that committed thousands of abuses against women and children. 12 people were ultimately convicted in the case that would prove to be one of the most successfully prosecuted cases of religious abuse in history. You can get hardbound, signed copies of Deceived at ProfilingEvil.com, or you can get paperback and ebook versions of the book at Amazon. And for those of you who wonder where the proceeds are going from this book, well, I'm really proud to say we're using them to help build a children's advocacy center, a place where victims of abuse can be forensically and medically examined in a home-like setting that's less threatening. Now, let's get back to today's discussion on cults. We just finished talking about some of the challenges faced by people leaving a cult. Our discussion reminds me of the effort cults put into mind manipulation, mind control, or thought reform. Dr. Robert J. Lifton shared some powerful tenets on thought reform in his book, 8 Criteria for Thought Reform. In there, Lifton spoke of the manner and method that cults employ to control communication between the members inside of the cult. This process allowed cult leaders to effectively control each individual and the messaging to include individual thoughts. Now, in my experience, cults use a lot of smoke and mirror to convince their members that the leader has some kind of a divine authority, spiritual advancement, or exceptional talent or insights. This positions the leader to reinterpret historic events, even things like scripture. And the followers of these cults usually believe their interpretations to be inspired. These leaders exploit coincidences in the news, and they interpret them as prophecy. And while their world is often black and white, they skillfully use things like guilt and shame to demand compliance from their followers. Cult leaders often demand their members confess sins and misdeeds publicly, and anything that's shared in private will probably be exploited and used by the leadership to maintain control of the individual. Lifton taught that cults convince their members that the group's doctrine or ideology is the ultimate truth, and it's unquestioned and undisputed. Cult members are taught that there is no truth outside of the group. The leader is considered the spokesman for all humanity. Criticizing the leader or questioning is absolutely unacceptable. Cults and cult leaders will interpret words and phrases in ways that benefit the group. They'll remind the members that people who aren't members of the group aren't going to understand the doctrine. This includes thought-terminating cliches designed to alter the members' thoughts, feelings, and emotions with a goal of transforming their thoughts to the group's way of thinking. Members in these closed societies are taught that their pre-cult experiences are unimportant, that anything that was taught outside of the group is incorrect. The cult leader has the prerogative to decide what's right and wrong. Who exists and who doesn't? In the extreme, this may mean that a person may be a member of the group, but others might be rejected. It only makes sense to these people in their own wacky way because they believe that these people somehow are different, and people outside of the cult are going to perish at the end of the world.
Well, they isolate us. They encourage us to become socially isolated within the group, where the only people we really have a meaningful relationship with are other group members. And so there's this constant reinforcement. And we all rely on the context of our socialization to know what is real, what is not real. And in this kind of bubble environment that is created by the group, they can distort what your perception of reality is by controlling everything around you, by controlling information, what you read, who you converse with. If everything that goes into the mind can be controlled by a group, they can begin to influence and manipulate the mind itself. So I think all of us should recognize that we're all susceptible to persuasion techniques. If we weren't, there would be no advertising, no political ads, no celebrity endorsements. People would say, I don't care if Michael Jordan likes those shoes. Doesn't mean anything to me. And so, of course, Michael Jordan, who's a very wealthy man from celebrity endorsement income, he would have to say, look, you know, I realize the influence I have. And of course, now in social media, we actually have a category of people called influencers who hawk products and have large followings on Twitter, on Instagram, on Facebook. And then they market it and leverage it and make money from it. So all of this would not be possible if human beings were not susceptible to influence. And so what I would ask the audience that's listening or watching now to think about is, imagine if you're a cult leader and you take all those techniques, you distill them, you make them even more potent, and then you focus them like a laser on a group of people that you have isolated and cut off from any outside frame of reference, from any accurate feedback other than what you orchestrate. How then can you control their thinking, their emotions, everything? So that's the key to understanding what has been called cult brainwashing, is just understanding the principles of influence. And these principles can be used for good or they can be used for bad. For example, we respect authority. If a police officer comes to my door and he's in his uniform and he asks me questions, I'm going to be very cooperative. I'm going to feel this is a person who has authority. If somebody comes to my door dressed in cut-off jeans and a tank top and they haven't shaved in a week, I'm going to think this person has no authority. I'm not going to respond to them well. So the perception of authority is one of the principles of influence. And so we have cult leaders who manipulate the scriptures, who say they speak for God or some higher power, because they recognize the power of speaking from authority.
One of my worst nightmares about cults is my personal opinion that destructive cults will only get worse over time. Dr. Benjamin Zablocki of Rutgers University believes this happens because members have such a high regard for this oft-charismatic leader that they may have. More destructive behaviors seem inevitable, and they include financial, psychological, physical, and sexual abuse. From time to time, group members might escape. Some may be expelled from the group. But for the families of cult members, this period of waiting is long and painful. They watch helplessly as their loved ones donate everything they possess to the cult, temporally and spiritually. It's my opinion that they're either showing their absolute obedience to the leader, their allegiance, their acceptance of the doctrine, or it's an attempt at purchasing eternal life. But almost like clockwork, if and when they offend the leader, they will likely be thrown out on their ear with empty pockets and a whole lot of emotional baggage that they didn't sign up for. The question that's always lingered in the back of my mind is, how can people like you and me help someone that we love get out of a cult, how could we offer something of value that the cult member would consider? Let's listen to Rick Ross as he responds to my very question in this regard.
Well, that would be wonderful. I mean, many of the families that call me would, you know, they would be absolutely thrilled if their family member said, "I'm thinking of leaving this group." And of course, the number one thing is to be a good listener, to listen to that person who's involved in a group, to never shame them. Don't make them feel that they have to be humiliated to leave. Let them know that they will be loved, that they are cherished, and that if they leave the group, you're there for them. You've got their back. And make them feel that leaving is going to be as reasonable and easy as possible, and that you're certainly not going to create any impediments for them through guilt or shame. But if they're totally in the group and they're a true believer and they're not exhibiting any doubts or willingness to reconsider their involvement, don't judge them. Don't confront them and say, "Oh, you're in a cult, you're brainwashed," because that will just get their back up. And moreover, they will go back to someone in the group and say, "You know, my dad or my mom or my brother said this to me. What do you think?" I mean, you should assume that whatever you say to them is going to be repeated to their handlers in the group, and they're going to be coached. So you don't want to assault them with that kind of verbiage, because it will end up boomeranging back on you in reduced communication, reduced access. So what you want to do is be very loving, very supportive, find common ground. Talk to them about things other than the group, its beliefs. Don't be critical. Be affirming as far as they're concerned. I'm not advocating lying to them and saying, "Oh, I think your group is great and everything the group is doing is great." But do not argue with them. Avoid the group as a subject of conversation. Find other things to talk about. And what you should do yourself is do some research. There are books out there like the ones that I've mentioned, my book, Cults Inside Out, Cialdini's book, Influence, Lifton, Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism. There are many books that you can read to help you understand how cults operate, the kind of manipulation that they use, so that you're tuned in and you know what to watch for and how to respond.
I think it's important to realize that someone who's been in a cult, especially if they've been there for an extended period of time, is emotionally traumatized and in many ways broken. They may eventually come to the realization that they were duped, but they're left with this internal struggle of reality that they chose poorly when they joined the group. When we help someone who's fleeing a cult, that is not the time for us to say, "I told you so." It's a time for support and understanding. It's a time to be supportive plus just a listening ear. Leaving a cult will likely be a long and painful journey for the individual who's doing it. And experts suggest that the longer a person's in the cult, the more difficult leaving is. If the cult member is generational, such as some of the children in polygamous groups that I investigated, coming to terms with what happened and what they are feeling can be terribly challenging. Listen as Rick discusses this phenomenon with me.
You know, what's interesting to me, Mike, are all these young people, these kids who were born in cults, raised in cults, and they don't know any other life. And when they do leave, and I've talked to so many of them, for example, victims of the Children of God, which is a particularly horrible group founded by Moses David Berg that promoted the idea that children should begin having sex at the age of 4. And Berg raped his granddaughter, raped his daughter, and basically he was a pedophile. And when these young people leave Children of God, and I've talked to many of them and other children that leave destructive cults, they have this ambivalent feeling about their parents. on one hand, they think, I love my mom, I love my dad. But on the other hand, I hate them because they brought me into this group. And what I try to help them realize and unpack is your parents were also victims. They were under the influence of the group. They were manipulated by the leader. They would never have done the things they did free to honestly act on their own, independently, not under the influence of the group. And so for these kids, their recovery process can be very, very difficult. And some of them just don't make it, like the actor River Phoenix. I don't know if you remember him, but he was nominated for an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor. And he had a brilliant career, and he died at the age of, I think, 26 from a drug overdose. And that's how many people that left the same group that River Phoenix was in, the Children of God, that's how they ended their lives. They were self-medicating. They were trying to take drugs as a way of numbing the pain that they had from their memories of the group. So, you know, I've worked with a lot of children coming out of cults in Ohio. There was one particular group where 21 children were removed by Child Protective Services, and I work with them. And I think a lot of times we forget the pain of these children. And of course, in the polygamous groups like that you have worked with, you see that pain. You see these kids who are growing up in a group that they never chose and that they become victims of.
Rick's comments remind me of a comment made by one of the survivors of the Zion Society cult. Our conversation occurred 30 years after the abuses that this young woman endured. She struggled with the cult's influence on her life for more than a dozen years after she left its clutches. She said that it was about that time when she came to a realization. She said this, "I spent most of my life being told what to think. It wasn't until two decades after leaving the group that I finally went to college, and there they taught me how to think." This survivor shared something really important about what was termed homeschooling back then. Many of these groups choose to homeschool children in their group. But make no mistake about it, folks. These groups aren't doing it because they think they can teach them better than the school system. They're doing it to maintain control of the children. This was all so reminiscent of the Children of God cult, and I found so many similarities between that cult and the Zion Society cult. Well, I hope you're enjoying Profiling Evil's Season 2 podcast, Cults Among Us. We're going to continue to explore cults like the Children of God next in a few weeks. So please make sure you're hitting the like and the subscribe button. That way you're going to get all the notifications. Now, this idea of cult manipulation in the daily lives of its members and how it remains a part of their psyche long after they leave became the next topic that I visited with Rick about. Listen in.
Yeah, and you know, Mike, a lot of groups, they block their people from having a college education. They don't want their members to go to college. In fact, they homeschool their kids. And this is all part of their effort to control the environment, to control information, and to manipulate people. And so what many of these groups find is that if our children go to college, they end up dropping away from the group because they learn to critically think and analyze information in college. And they're exposed to a wider world of experience. And they realize, wait a minute, that group that I was in, it wasn't really the way that I thought it was or the way I was told it was. And of course, the children they don't have the emotional equity that an adult has that has joined the group, which you alluded to, Mike, which is if I'm a parent and I brought my children into this group and they were treated in a certain way that really bothers me, and I'm responsible for that, you as a parent have a reason to deny that the group is destructive. Because if you accept that the group is destructive, then you begin to feel the guilt of bringing your family in. And, you know, this is what we call a cognitive dissonance. That is, when people are confronted with facts that directly contradict their beliefs, how do they navigate that? How do they deal with that? And so what the group does is the group puts a spin on it. Warren Jeffs is in prison as the leader of the polygamous group FLDS, and the group says because he's a martyr, he's innocent, he's holy, he's suffering for all of us, we should praise God that he's there like a sacrificial lamb. And so the group has a way of resolving the dissonance that is between the facts that Warren Jeffs is a pedophile and he was arrested for sexual crimes against minor children, and the belief of the group, which is that he is a great leader, that God has ordained him to lead us. And so the group creates a spin, and people accept that spin. And especially people who feel that they have great equity in the group, that they've sacrificed greatly for the group. For example, there are Waco Davidians that survived the fire. Like, for example, Clive Doyle, who I write about in my book, as an example of cognitive dissonance. He lost his family, he lost his daughter, his grandchild in that fire in Waco. And he recognized, I think, that the prophecies that David Koresh gave the group did not come true. At the end, when he died, the world did not end. The world was not judged. It wasn't the eschatological termination of the world. It was just another day, a tragic day, and life went on. But for Clive Doyle, he has to, in his mind, rationalize that, because otherwise he would have to confront the reality that David Koresh was a con man, that his real name, you know, was Vernon Howell, and that he wasn't supernatural. And that Clive Doyle would then have to say, my loved ones died for nothing.
I explored these kinds of issues in my book, Deceived, and I hope you'll grab that. I leaned on the expertise of my friend, Dr. Yanya Lalig, and we talked a great deal about how to define cults and what some of the recruiting techniques are that they have. Dr. Lalig taught me that cults can be either sharply bounded or diffusely bounded, a social movement held together through a shared commitment to a charismatic leader. Cults stick together in a belief system that requires a high level of personal commitment. And while their ideologies may differ, their behaviors are very similar. Cults exist on a continuum of influence and control, and they're frequently totalistic and separatist. Dr. Lalig taught me that people in cults tend to espouse an all-encompassing belief system where they exhibit excessive devotion to and dependency on that perfect leader. Criticizing the group or its leader's practices is strictly prohibited, but feeling a sense of disdain for non-group members is encouraged. This definition really makes me think about the groups we each belong to. Think about the groups you belong to. Are they inclusive or divisive? Are they destructive or benign? Do they tend to focus outwardly or inwardly? What would your personal definition of a cult be? I'm going to be watching for your comments down below, and thanks for putting them in there. And folks, thanks for listening. You can find Profiling Evil on YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And again, if you like podcasts, make sure you're looking up Profiling Evil on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget, you can find us on the World Wide Web at profilingevil.com. And for those of you that are interested in doing a little more, consider joining our channel memberships, especially the Profiling Evil Academy. Links are down below. And while you're at it, one more time, please hit that like and subscribe button. It really does help us. Well, thanks for all your support, and we'll see you soon at the next crime scene. Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is TruthFinder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give TruthFinder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing, but you got to click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time.